Something that's been on my mind the past many years is trying to understand my role and responsibility to myself, to my community, to society as a whole, in speaking out against injustice, speaking up for equality, making sure that I am personally acting in a way that doesn't harm others, and pursuing knowledge as a part of a quest to make the world a better place. It's a journey that I hope and imagine will last as long as I live. I doubt I'll ever understand the perfect balance of, well, anything. But some of the conversations we have on this show helps put certain puzzle pieces in place, or at least in the general vicinity of what feels like a good way of living. Today is one of those episodes, and it made me realize that I'm not alone in this quest, because you, the listener, continue to check in every week. And we as a global community are not alone in this quest, because many of these questions have been asked in the margins of Torah for thousands of years by brilliant and sometimes not so brilliant scholars, which means perhaps it's indeed not about finding all the answers, but making sure you're on track in asking the right questions. And each of us has the right to pose these questions. Which all sounds broad, because it is. Today we ask some big, broad, sweeping questions about justice, community, about having the resources needed to enact mercy, and how Torah fits in through all the cracks of nuance. To do so, we are in conversation with Washington State Supreme Court Justice Raquel Montoya Lewis. Justice Montoya Lewis is the first Native American to serve on the Washington State Supreme Court, and the second Native American to serve on a state Supreme Court nationwide. She previously served as Chief Judge for the Lummi, Nooksack, and Upper Skagit tribes, giving her a comprehensive understanding of issues affecting Native Americans and Indigenous people. And we'll discuss the differences in serving Indigenous versus United States courts and what she sees as missing from our modern judicial systems. Last week, Professor Katya Gibble-Mevorach talked about race as a verb. And today, Justice Montoya Lewis will talk about justice as a verb. And I'm starting to sense that there's a through line here about our responsibility to take some of the things we thought immovable and move them around, springing them into action and changing who we are in the process. I'm excited to have Rabbi Matt back with us. I'm excited about all the episodes we're planning for you. I'm excited about the world slowly getting to a place where I could possibly share a Shabbat table with some of you in the near future. And I'm really glad you're here. I heard from listener Kendall this week about how these episodes have been helping ground her and her daughter in these insane times. And Kendall, I'm right there with you. Thank you for your very generous support. If you want to be cool like Kendall, support us over at patreon.com/thestudy. Evan and I are beginning to look at how to build a season 2, and if it's possible at all. So to help keep the lights on, anything you can toss in the Study Tzedakah box will be deeply appreciated. Thanks again, Kendall, and Shabbat Shalom to your family. You can always reach out to us on Twitter @study_show. We can always use your help in rating and reviewing the show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you somehow have any friends that don't listen to our show, share one of your favorite episodes. It might just be this one. Hoping for a peaceful Shabbat and for the many weeks ahead. On to the show. I'm very glad to welcome back to the show Rabbi Matt Green from Congregation Beth Elohim in Brooklyn, New York. Rabbi Matt, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here as always.
And I'm so honored to be in conversation today with Washington State Supreme Court Justice, Justice Raquel Montoya Lewis. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Justice Montoya Lewis, you are the first Native American justice to serve on the Washington State Supreme Court and the second Native American to serve on a state Supreme Court nationwide. But you also served as the chief judge for the Lummi, Nooksack, and Upper Skagit tribes in Washington State. To set the stage for today, could you talk broadly about how tribal courts differ from federal and state courts?
Sure, I'd be happy to, and I appreciate the question, as I think tribal courts often don't get really thought about, but there's some really remarkable work going on in tribal courts. Every federally recognized tribe has the authority to run their own tribal court system. Not all of them do, but many of them do, and they are as varied as each tribe is. So I have worked for tribes that have very large, complex legal systems that look very similar to a state court system, both in terms of the layout of the courtroom and the role of the judge. There are lawyers, the tribal court laws is laid out in a format that would be familiar to any attorney. And I've also worked for tribes, including my own tribe, that has very little written law, where the courtroom wouldn't look like a courtroom to most people, where sometimes the judge isn't even necessarily law trained, isn't necessarily a lawyer, and the court functions on tribal, what's called tribal customary law, the law of that particular tribe. So the range of the work that goes on in tribal courts is extremely wide. Our jurisdiction is limited by Congress and limited in some cases by the Supreme Court and by the federal courts. But we do try to do as much as we can working in concert with state courts when we have families who are seen in both the state court system and the tribal court system, which happens a lot.
Does that make it difficult to jump from one tribal court to another when each one has a different set of ground rules, where I imagine state Supreme Court, state courts all kind of play under the same rules?
Yeah, that's a very thoughtful question. It's and you're exactly right. My experience as a tribal court judge, I was a tribal court judge for 15 years before I became a state court judge. And so I worked for many different tribes, some of whom I would come in and do one case, and others that I would, where I was the chief judge for several years. And I would have to figure out as quickly as possible what the law of that particular tribe was, how the court system functioned, what their expectations were about what the judge should do, whether there were attorneys, whether there were not attorneys. It was very difficult to come in and just do one or two cases, leave, go to another court. And many tribal court judges do that. They go to multiple tribes and work for multiple different kinds of court systems. So it's very challenging work. It's really interesting. It's really exciting work, but it can be very complicated to come into a community that you're not from, where you may not even speak the primary language, and that has a tradition and culture that is most often not familiar to you unless you happen to be working for your own tribe, which is pretty unusual. So it's very complex. And one of the things that has been really interesting to me moving into the state court system, I was a superior court judge for 5 years before coming onto the Washington State Supreme Court, is that there was a perception on the part of lawyers and judges that what we were doing in the tribal courts was sort of lesser than in terms of what was going on in the state court system. If you know the state court system, you know it, and you can access the law pretty quickly. We all know what we're talking about. We're all on the same page. That's not the case in the tribal courts. And so it is a very different kind of work as a lawyer and as a judge.
You're also Jewish on your mother's side. Could you talk a bit about your relationship to Judaism, both as a Native American and as a lawyer and legal scholar?
What's been interesting about becoming more and more of a public figure is that I'm finding there are far more Native American Jewish folks around than I knew. I knew a few. There really are a number of us, and it makes a lot of sense to me because there are many things in the Jewish culture that are relatable in terms of what is going on in Native communities. Our communities are both about family, are both often many traditions around food. There's sort of a constant awareness about what we're doing and its connection to the larger world and the larger community and our responsibility to that. And so those things for me as a Jewish woman and as a Native woman really cross over and are kind of I find in both parts of my life that those things are very rarely in conflict. Over the last year or so, I think largely related to the pandemic, which has sort of had the effect of forcing me to sort of slow down. When you're able to work at home, you can work all the time. And so I had to be very conscious about setting some boundaries around that. It's really given me the opportunity to become a part of a Jewish congregation in Olympia, where I live now in Washington. And that's been a real gift to me. And that community is very centered around the concept of justice and what it means to be a good person, what it means to be part of a larger community, what our responsibilities are to one another. Those questions are central to everything I've done in my career and certainly matter to me in my day-to-day life. So, as a Jewish woman, finding that community in a place that is new to me, we moved here when I was appointed to this position, has been really a wonderful part of this move and really exciting.
Well, Rabbi Matt, it sounds like you and I have to go spend a Shabbat up in Olympia now that the world is reopening sometime soon. I'm really glad to have you here with us and truly thrilling to be studying some ancient judicial-themed text with a state Supreme Court justice. Rabbi Matt, might you be ready to walk us through this week's Torah portion, Naso?
Absolutely. And first of all, Justice Montoya Lewis, I'm really excited to be here with you. And already I can tell from what you said that there is a lot. I mean, I'm excited to learn more about the overlap between Jewish and Native traditions, especially when it comes to laws. This week's Torah portion is pretty devoted to laws, as is maybe unsurprising. Parshat Naso is actually the longest Torah portion in the entire Torah, believe it or not, Raviv. And it starts out with a census. Last week we were talking about a census. Here too we get a census of the Levites. And actually the Parsha then ends with a very, very long chapter about Levites and tribal chiefs giving certain gifts to the Levites and the temple cult writ large. So I guess that brings us back also to thinking about dues to Jewish institutional life. But really, I think the meat or the exciting piece of Parshat Naso is what happens in the middle, where we get a number of laws around maintaining communal sanctity by dealing with threats of impurity and dealing with betrayal. And most famously, that appears in the case of the Sota ritual, which is a ritual to confirm whether or not a wife has been adulterous, which is a form of betrayal. But I think what would be most useful for us right now is actually to focus on really just one verse, because I think that gets us into our conversation most neatly. And it really appears in the middle of this Torah portion. And I'm looking at Numbers 5, chapter 5, verse 6. And actually, it's 6 and 7. So I think I'll just read it directly. God spoke to Moses saying, "Speak to the Israelites. When men or women individually commit any wrong toward a fellow human being, thus breaking faith with God, and they realize their guilt, they shall confess the wrong that they have done. They shall make restitution in the principal amount and add one-fifth to it, giving it to the one who was wronged." So essentially what that's saying is a few things. I mean, the English is actually quite vague. It's about wronging people and breaking faith with God. Really, this is about theft. And taking someone's property. The Hebrew is ma'al. It says lim'ol ma'al, which refers to the inadvertent and intentional misappropriation of property. And so specifically, they're trying to figure out here or command the Israelites around what to do when a person steals from another person. And importantly, we've got a few categories here. Ish o isha, man or woman. So this is, it applies to both sexes here. And it does speak in the language of sex and not gender. And it also says, ki yasu mikol chatot ha'adam, meaning when they wrong any human being, not just Jews. And so I think that's also interesting because elsewhere the Torah focuses on when an Israelite wrongs another Israelite. Here, they speak the language of all human beings. And I think we might have something to talk about here around when laws apply between Jews and Jews, or when laws apply between Jews and all of humanity. I think there's something interesting there. But even though I've opened the door for some of those later conversations, I think the key point here is that the Torah is giving us a very clear definition of wronging someone when you steal from them or take their property, and giving us the very clear example of restitution by giving people back, returning to them the value of their property, and then adding one-fifth to it as punishment. For what it's worth, that's actually a limited version. Earlier in the Bible, I think in Exodus, we learn that they're supposed to, as penalty, they're supposed to pay double the value of what they have stolen. But intriguingly, in the Numbers version, they make it one-fifth in addition, because as far as I can tell from many of the commentaries, by offering 20% more, you're more likely to get someone to do this willingly than if you force them to give twice the value of what was stolen. These verses are interesting because it really sets the stage for what will then become a whole Talmud's worth of laws and penalties and trying to figure out what to do when someone steals from another person. But I think we can focus on that, or we can think about how this applies to men and women equally, and also not just Jews among themselves, but for Jews and all people. So therein we find a lot of ways in. Raviv, which do you think we should go? Which direction should we go in next?
I want to go in all the different directions all at once. I do want to nitpick something. So at the beginning of the statement, it includes, like you say, both men and women among potential perpetrators. But the wrong that's done is toward fellow man, and the restitution paid is to him who he has wronged. Is this a matter of collapsing pronouns into he and him, or is there something gendered concerning halacha's concept of who can be wronged versus who can be held responsible?
Well, I'm pleased to say in this case, it is actually inclusive of everybody. The word used is adam, which means humanity. And so
Okay. They've
just collapsed the pronouns in the translation. Elsewhere, there's what to say about misogyny and focused only on men, et cetera, but here it's actually when any individual steals from any individual.
You know, reading rabbinic commentary on this passage, we have Rabbi Or HaChaim, who states that in the event of perjury, it isn't the soul of the sinner that has been tarnished, but rather the collective soul of the Jewish people. Judge Montoya Lewis, this makes me think of the fact that in America, when you commit a crime, you're not prosecuted by the victim, but rather by the state. You've harmed the state as a collective idea and are therefore set apart from the collective, having been rendered an outsider. Do you view this as being fundamentally different from having tarnished the collective soul of a people, which isn't from the outside, but from within?
It's analogous in a way, but I think it's less about thinking of the collective so much as it's an attempt to try to take the responsibility of decision-making about who is prosecuted and who isn't prosecuted out of the hands of the victim or the victim's family. I think the intent is both that there's been a harm done to everyone because there's been a harm done to a person, but also that in an attempt to try to avoid vengeance or to avoid the decision-making about whether or not we're going to exact you know, revenge versus restitution becomes the decision of kind of an outsider, the people, whoever's representing the people. I'm not convinced that that's necessarily functioning the way we would hope it would, but I think that it's a little bit different than the idea that we've all been harmed as a result of the actions of the individual in our system. We call them the defendant, more so that it's our responsibility to act on behalf of the victim as a collective.
It strikes me that we're talking here about rules for 12 tribes, which makes me wonder if there's any commonality between the nature of what's harmed in this context and the nature of what's harmed in the context of the tribes that you presided over. So when a crime is committed among a Native American tribe, where does the collective or the tribe fit into the picture of who is farmed or what soul is tarnished, like we were just talking about?
Yeah, I think that it is really different than the way we think about it in the state and federal court systems. And, you know, a long time ago, a couple of hundred years ago, maybe not quite that far back, there was a case that came out of a tribe that where someone was murdered, and the tribe managed the resolution internally, and the decision was about what to do about the person who had murdered someone else came out of discussions in the community about what penance that person should pay. And it involved a discussion with the family and the family of the victim. And so there was an agreement that that person was going to kind of repay the family and the community by doing a variety of things. But what didn't occur was that the person wasn't banished. There wasn't a prison term. There weren't the things that we sort of in, I think, Western society think of as punishment. The U.S. Congress at that time said tribes don't have the ability to manage criminal cases because they are too primitive and they're coming up with these solutions that don't punish the person on behalf of the people or the state. And that's actually the beginning of where tribes began to lose a lot of jurisdiction over the ability to prosecute criminal acts. It's not the only reason. There were lots of others. But in my experience working for multiple different tribes, there is certainly the ability to use things like jail time and fines and restitution and those kinds of things. But there is always an understanding, and this is something that should be, I think, the understanding kind of nationwide, but it's not been my experience. There's always an understanding in a criminal case in the tribal community that person, even if you send them away to prison for some period of time, is going to come back and continue to be a part of the community. And so it's the responsibility of not just the court, but the community to welcome that person back and help them to find what their role will be in the community going forward. In state court systems, I have never really seen that be a conscious thought process on the part of courts or even communities. I think when we think about someone who's committed a crime, we call them a criminal, and that's the label that they have forever. In tribal communities, there's much more of an ethos that we're kind of all in this together. Not all of us do all the right things all of the time. And so together we have to figure out how we continue to, you know, be in community with each other, even when someone has caused a harm to someone else in the same community.
I want to pick up on that. I love that, and I love it for many reasons. Personally, I think it's beautiful, but also it has a deep resonance with a Jewish response to, let's say, a crime or a sin or an error in some way, in some communal way. And I'm thinking about how in all these laws that we're talking about in the Torah, there are mechanisms in place to bring a person back into the community after they have committed a sin. And most of these, even though actually this Torah portion is focused on the crime of theft, among other things, in general, the Torah is speaking the language of sin. And a person always has an opportunity to do tshuva when they sin. And tshuva, of course, we translate as repentance, but really means return. And it's return back to the society, return back to a stasis, a relationship with God, but perhaps most important, it's a return to society. And intriguingly, even in that verse that we refer to from the very beginning, it's useful when I have the Hebrew in front of me, it literally says, "V'hitvadu et chatam," meaning they shall confess the wrong. That word is intriguing because you may know it, vidui, v'hitvadu is the same word vidui, which is the confessional we do at different times throughout our lives, but specifically on Yom Kippur, which is our yearly opportunity as Jews to confess our wrongs as a collective, because we have a recognition that all of us are accountable for the wrongs of one another. And so I think in that we see two resonances with some of what you're saying. On the one hand, it's collective, that there is a desire to see, or an awareness that we're all in this together, and that anyone who commits a sin or a crime in some way is still part of a collective and we're all responsible for them. But also, Jewish tradition is not so interested in locking people up forever. It's more interested in finding ways to bring them back.
That's really helpful context, because I feel like sometimes during Yom Kippur, when I'm doing vidui and talking about all the listing all of the horrible things that I've done over the past year that I actually haven't done, thinking about it in terms of the community and what we actually need to look out for and who we need to look out for and how we are all responsible for each other. That's actually a really helpful context in just thinking about that prayer alone, let alone my place in the universe and my community. It makes me wonder, you know, whether it's tribal law or the context of Jewish and Torah law, does tribal law have a specific basis in religion or spirituality?
Well, I'd say it depends on the tribe. Again, so many tribes in the United States were moved from their original homelands by the federal government that there's been a tremendous culture loss, language loss, human loss over the history of this country, that I think it's fair to say that there are many tribes who are so far from where they started, from where their homelands are or were, that sometimes access to that information, what the traditions and customs and spiritual life were, is gone. Hmm. I happen to come from a tribe in New Mexico that was never removed, and that's true of the vast majority of the tribes that are in New Mexico. My particular tribe has been there for thousands of years, is a very intact language, very intact legal system and tribal customary system that is absolutely tied to the religious beliefs of the community. And most of those beliefs and the way that those practices are followed are things that are not something, if you're an outsider, that you have access to. You don't get to know, basically. If you're not in it, you don't have the information. And so I think for many people, they might look at the tribal court that I once worked in my own tribe as the primary system of laws. And it is, if you happen to be in the tribal court. But if you've done something, or you are seeking justice in the traditional customary way, there's a different way to do that that is absolutely through the religious teachings of our community. So there's kind of two systems working at the same time, and there is some overlap, but there's also places where there's no overlap. I was explaining this to someone once a couple of years ago, and they were saying that it's sort of this metaphysical system because there's things happening that you don't necessarily, that aren't necessarily visible, but have a huge impact on what's going on the part that is visible. I guess what I'm trying to describe is those are kind of two extremes. One where you have completely written down law that anyone can pick up and look at, and anyone can walk into a courtroom, and other communities where that's not accessible at all, and everything in between. I think that in my experience in working with tribes over the last 20 years is that most of our tribal communities are deeply committed to ensuring that our communities remain and for the future. And so the commitment in the tribes to families and children and what that looks like in the court system, obviously that's a very, for want of a better word, kind of spiritual approach, right? You're not just thinking about what I do today and what the impact that has on the person sitting in front of me, but also on their grandchildren and their grandchildren's grandchildren. I saw that played out in front of me as a judge all the time. And again, I think that's something we might aspire to in the state system and in some respects, but it's absolutely not something that is stated. And that is something in virtually every tribal community I've worked in that's it's a stated and conscious value system. And it's about survival.
I had the great pleasure to spend some time on different reservations over the past few years. And the idea of the seventh generation, looking ahead at the effect on grandchildren and grandchildren's grandchildren, like it unfortunately makes so much sense that so many of those ideals don't line up with the American capitalist system. We work on the quarterly profit system. We're only looking ahead 3 months, let alone seven generations, and absolutely agree that there's so much to aspire to there. I guess I want to flip that question around, I guess, and ask the same about Jewish law. Do we know if there are any Jewish laws, specifically from Torah, I guess, that are woven into American common law?
Well, I don't know if I can say that that's true in a conscious sense. I think it's largely not. I think I was taught in law school, and before I went to law school, I'd never talked to a lawyer. I had never met anyone who'd gone to law school. I didn't know what I was getting into in any way, shape, or form. So I came in pretty naive, and I was sort of presented with the idea that what we were learning in law school was objective, right? That the things we were learning were these sort of external rules, and our job was to understand what those rules were and how to think about ways to apply them to real world situations. Although in my particular law school, we didn't talk about the real world a whole lot. It was very sort of theoretical. I pretty quickly realized, I think largely because I am such an outsider, given who I am, that none of those things were about anything objective. They all had a viewpoint interwoven with them. And I think that's something that is relatively well accepted as an idea now, but 25, 30 years ago when I was in law school, the idea that law wasn't an objective thing was something seen as something that was pretty radical to say, even though from my perspective, it seemed utterly obvious. So, I think that the tension that you're describing between restitution versus punishment versus revenge is a tension that exists in our legal system and is sort of this constant debate, not just on the criminal side, but I saw it when I did divorces, for the families fighting not just over assets, but over who gets to see kids and when and why. And it's that tension. I want revenge. I want this person to suffer. A divorce where someone, with the family saying, well, we want to work together and try to continue to have a healthy family, even though it's in some different form. The way you come to resolution about those things are absolutely informed by your beliefs. So I don't know that I could say specifically that there's something from Jewish law that has a direct impact, but much of what we're talking about today are things that I see us as a sort of collective society trying to come up with answers to. And I think it's a mistake to describe the law as some external objective thing that you can apply and solve those problems with in some simple way, because it all involves people and their problems, and none of us are simple.
At one table, they believe that Shabbat is more than a day of the week. It's a state of being. As May marks Mental Health Awareness Month, we're giving ourselves extra permission to slow down and reconnect with ourselves each week. For resources to help you reclaim that Shabbat feeling and take care of you and your loved ones, visit onetable.org/mental health.
I really appreciate you drawing us to think about the power structures in place as laws are created, and the fact that these laws often, many laws have an agenda. And I think that, Raviv, I am certainly not an expert on American law, really, at all, although I do live here and am subject to those laws. But I know that there is a lot of effort to refer to a kind of Judeo-Christian origin to many of our American laws, right? This is why I'm guessing many people around the country have chosen to put the Ten Commandments in front of courthouses and things like that, to try to draw or make some argument that the basis of American law and American society is the Bible. Intriguingly, I think that it's not usually Jews who are making those arguments. It's usually Christians. And even the phrase Judeo-Christian, I think, is kind of a misnomer in a number of ways. But I therefore don't really know the answer about how Jewish law impacts American law. My guess would be that it's mostly in the imagination of people who want to see some religious origin to our laws here. But I think importantly, one of the key differences between Jewish law and, let's say, American law is what we're talking about. It sounds like there are many more similarities between various native traditions in Jewish law because of the importance of the collective. And that maybe we have an idea in America that we're all part of some American project, but really, America is a pretty individualistic country, and that's been true since the very beginning. Nothing could be further from Jewish society, where it's all about the collective. I mean, there's the tradition that all Jews are responsible for one another. Really, what they are is guarantors for one another. We talk frequently about how Jews have a responsibility to stick up for other Jews, but really they are arevim, they are guarantors, meaning that Jews are responsible for the ability for all other Jews to live their best lives and to live up to their potential. That's a very different way of understanding society and laws than our American way of doing things.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that brings me to my next question about justice and mercy, and this is going to be fairly broad, but per the Torah, the commandments are to love those like us, those different from us, and to love God. They're fulfilled through acting with both justice and mercy. So, Judge, how do you define justice and mercy?
That's a great question, and I think ties right into this conversation about, you know, what you just describe Rabbi as this American project. You know, I, again, was raised with the idea, as we're all taught in school, right? That, you know, what justice means is that everything is fair, everything is equal, that if one person steals something, they get the same punishment as the next person who steals the same thing. I don't really see that as justice. And that has really come through unlearning a lot of the things I was taught about American history and about the way government works and the way the law works. I really think now when I'm thinking about what justice means, I very much think of justice as an action, not an external sort of, you know, thing that exists without people. For me, justice is about equity. It is certainly about fairness. But when I worked in tribal courts, and this was true really of every tribe I worked for, there was an expectation that I understood the people who were in front of me in the context of the community, what their roles were, who they were related to, what their family history was. That also meant I needed to understand as much as I could about the tribal community's history. And the expectation was that I understood those things so that whatever the solution was, whether you were talking about a crime or something else, was a solution that took into account the whole person and where they fit in their community and what they contributed, what their struggles were, how they got to where they were sitting in front of a judge. And in the state court system, I not only didn't have access to that information, I wasn't allowed to go seek it. As a judge, the idea is you make decisions based on what someone gives you in court, and that's it. You can't go trying to understand more about this person. And I was fairly limited in what I could know about the people that came in front of me, which was a huge and very frustrating adjustment for me. And the reason it was so frustrating is that I couldn't sort out really how I could come up with a just solution or a decision where mercy, is giving someone a sentence on that included restorative options like going to drug treatment or something like that, if I didn't have the big picture. And I was generally, that big picture was generally unavailable to me. The other thing is that, as you're talking about our what we do as being a reflection of our community and that we are, guarantors for one another, it made me think about some of the struggles I have felt as a judge because while I'm one of the very few Native people on state court benches and, even fewer on state Supreme Court benches, I do feel like as a symbol of the legal system, I'm responsible for that legal system. Even when people do or say things as judges or, as part of people who are part of the legal system that I utterly disagree with and think are wrong, it's still part of my responsibility to recognize that that is part of our system. And that's another part of what I think justice is. I think that we are collectively responsible for the legal system. And I think it's pretty well accepted that our legal system is unfair to people of color, particularly on the criminal side of things, but not limited to that. And as long as our system is unfair in those ways, I don't think we can begin to really have a conversation about what's just.
When I think about justice and mercy, I think about the American legal system use of things like mandatory minimums, which set the floor for judges' sentencing requirements. And like you say, it seems like it strips judges of the power to find a fair balance between justice and mercy. I guess, Rabbi Matt, does halacha have guidelines to empower someone to waive, say, what's in this week's portion of the principal plus 20% sentence when there are actual circumstances that warrant mercy? If a hungry person steals food, do we have that built into this system?
Absolutely. I mean, Jewish law, both in the context of ancient Israelite law, as we find in the Torah, and also rabbinic law and the Talmud and I guess the practice of the current Orthodox legal system that is based on Jewish law, you find a sort of attitude that looks at the whole picture. And let's take the example of someone who can't pay, which is what you're asking. In our system in the United States, if someone can't pay an amount they have to pay, usually there is some kind of jail time, or usually there is some other punishment that is supposed to function as, some version of what they weren't able to pay for. But in Jewish law, there are public funds, essentially. And the public is very different because it's people who opt into it here, right? Because we opt into participating in Jewish law if we are observant in this country. But there would be a public fund that would be able to cover expenses for restitution, say. And that's also very different from what we find here. I think the fact of a public fund is another example of how Jewish law presumes that we are all responsible for one another, even people who commit a crime. Also, I would say you're talking about justice and mercy, these two ideas of din and rachamim that our tradition speaks a lot about. And, you know, famously, our tradition says that the world cannot function if either one of those things is missing. And so if we only have din, if we only have justice, then you have so many rules that it can be crushing because people make mistakes. But you have to have rules, obviously, to have a functioning society, and therefore mercy is necessary and is what makes us sort of divine, or what makes us tap into the divinity of all human beings. That we have to play God a little bit and treat people with both justice and mercy all the time.
Judge Montoya-Lewis, I loved how you framed the idea of what you have access to as a judge within the Supreme Court system, the things that you might need to know to enact justice and especially mercy you may not have access to. Does the American legal system allow for any sufficient amount of judicial flexibility when it comes to the balance of justice and mercy? Or is it just flat out the law is the law?
Well, that might depend on who you ask. You know, I think that there's been a real movement over the last maybe decade or so towards really trying to move as much as we can towards a therapeutic approach on the criminal side of things, particularly for lower, quote unquote, lower level crimes. So I presided over a felony level drug court for several years, and the approach there was, let's get at the underlying problem. And when I worked in that setting, in a therapeutic drug court setting, I learned everything and more about everyone that came in front of me. I got to know their family histories. Sometimes they bring their families in with them. Many of them had burned every bridge that existed, and over the course of their time in our drug court would slowly begin to rebuild them. And so when a family member would want to come in, or a close friend, to hear what was going on in their lives in drug court, it was deeply meaningful. And you could sort of see the community, you know, see them rebuilding their own community. And, you know, that was always, I thought, a better approach, because I made better decisions when I had to make them. And they made better decisions before they ever got to me, right? We always said in drug court, which comes out of 12-step programs, you know, your job is to make the next right choice. And if we did our job right as a therapeutic court, then the people that we were working with would make next right choices without us having to be intervening. And that approach was something where, you know, as I said, I'd get to know people really well, and I'm still in touch with some of our clients who have since graduated and gone on to do other things. So it can work. And I think we have lots of data that shows those kinds of things can work, and not just with things like addiction, but even in cases where we have domestic violence. There are things called batterers intervention courts that have been studied and shown to reduce or end the cycle of violence in relationships. So I think those things are possible, but if you don't have someone for whom those kinds of approaches are available, either because the court system doesn't allow it, or the prosecutor won't recommend that person or allow that person to go that route, or any number of other problems, maybe they don't want to seek that kind of an approach, then the judges are very limited in what they can do. I can send someone to prison, and I can send them to prison for a period of time, and that's very circumscribed basically by like a chart, like a spreadsheet that says this is the seriousness of the crime, this is how many times they've been in front of judges before. You know, you match those two numbers and come up with a range of months. People would, I think, be very surprised, and have been, at how much those things that are intended to be objective actually reflect what we think the value of a crime is. So cases where, when I have conversations with people, when they think about things like sexual assault, they think of those as the most serious kinds of crimes. But very often, they don't carry with them the kinds of prison sentences that people assume they do. They often carry very low prison sentences. Those things come out of the legislature. They're not something that judges have have much of a say in, and it can be very frustrating when you're limited in those kinds of ways. So I hope I'm answering your question, but I think that the reason we have those kinds of charts and mandatory minimums and maximums is because there was an attempt to try to resolve, some of that racial disproportionality I talked about before. But I don't think it's had that effect. And I think the data demonstrates it has had virtually no effect on changing those things. And really all it's done is limit courts' abilities to address the larger issues. In my view, again, getting back to your question of what justice is, the only way we really get there is if we try to address the root causes and why someone is where they are. And there's very little, as far as I can see, interest in doing that.
Justice Raquel Montoya Lewis, thank you so, so much for joining us today and helping frame some of these really big ideas about justice and mercy and unpacking some Torah. I'm really honored to be in conversation with you today. So thank you.
Thank you. It was great to be a part of this conversation. Thank you, Rabbi Matt, as well.
It has been such a delight, especially Justice Montoya Lewis. I really was excited to learn from you today. So thank you.
Thank you.
And to all of our listeners, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Good morning, Judge. What may be my fine? Good morning, Judge. What may be my fine? Good morning, Judge. What may be my fine?
The study is produced by Evan Scott Nicholas and me, Raviv Ullman. My co-host today was Rabbi Matt Green. And our guest was Justice Raquel Montoya Lewis. Artwork by Julia Pott. We'll see you next week.
Rest me for murder, and I ain't never harmed a man. Rest me for forging, I can't sign my name.